Heroes. They're legends. They run faster. They hit harder. They're champions. Heroes always win. They beat the bad guys, save the day, and they still get home at 5. Deep down, we all long for heroes. We can't live without them. Heroes clean up the mess we've created. What makes someone heroic? Is it the ability to fly, or the ability to get back up after soaring too close to the sun? Is it dominating the forces of evil, or is it victory over the evil inside oneself? Does someone who never shows weakness make a hero, or is a hero someone who overcomes in spite of his weaknesses? Every hero has flaws, even the ones we read about in the Bible. In the life of David, a king of Israel and a man after God's own heart, we see a hero with glimpses of greatness and wounds of pride. Through David's scars and struggles, we see a greater hero. We see the one who fights life's biggest battles and wins. This hero is not another one of God's great heroes. He is God himself. Through his victory, we are made perfect. But until then, all heroes are flawed heroes.
All right. Well, hey, Traders Point. I hope you are doing well. Hope you're having a great weekend so far. Welcome to week 6 of our summer series called Flawed Hero. Now, over the summer, our lead pastor, Aaron, is on a sabbatical. And our elders are very intentional about providing periodic times for our leaders to rest and recuperate. So Aaron is spending time with his family, spending time with God, and ready to come back this fall, ready to go. There is a lot of exciting things that God is going to do in and through this church this fall, so we're excited to be a part of it. So if you are praying this week, really encourage you to pray for Aaron. Pray for all of the leaders here at the church. That would be awesome. But like John said, we are in a series where we are studying through a highlights package in the life of David. And if you're not all that familiar with the Bible, you need to know that David was a central figure in the whole story. He was a shepherd and a musician. He was a warrior and a king. In fact, he was so important that when people would describe how important Jesus was, they would mention that he was related to David. All right, so David's kind of a big deal. And he wasn't from a royal family. He was not from a big city. But he was God's chosen king, and that made all the difference. See, like we said last week, at this point in the life of David, he is now King David. He's no longer Shepherd David. He's no longer Little Brother David. He is King David. And I don't know if you knew this, but when you become the king, people treat you differently, right? It's very surprising, right? People stop saying no to you, and all they say is yes, sir. And you don't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from. You just have to decide what kind of steak you want that night. All right, that's the kind of king I would be. It wouldn't be if we were having steak, it'd be what kind of steak. All right, these are the decisions that a king makes. It's good to be the king. And he is no longer low man on the totem pole. He is now the top dog. And when you are on top of the world, you see the world very differently. And David's position has changed, and it started to change him. Started to change him on the inside, and today we're going to see how it comes out. So if you have a Bible or a Bible app, I'd love for you to join me. 2 Samuel chapter 11 is where we're going to be hanging out. That's where we'll begin. So head on over there, 2 Samuel 11. Now, the Bible is a fascinating book because it tells the entire story. In fact, one writer said that the Bible tells the truth about people. Right? The Bible tells the truth about people, and that's one of its signs of authenticity. That if this was all fiction, all these characters, all these people would be mythological superheroes. They would never make a mistake, they would have zero weaknesses, but that's not the case with the people in the Bible. The Bible is unafraid of telling us that these people, while important, were not perfect. Even the people that the Bible elevates as examples of faith, like be like these people, they're still obviously flawed. Take, for instance, Abraham, the father of the nation of Israel. On multiple occasions, he lied and told people that his wife was his sister because he was scared of what they might do to him. So instead of defending her dignity and honor, he was more interested in protecting his behind. All right, that was Abraham. And then there was Moses, the great liberator of Israel, the one that freed them from slavery in Egypt. Well, he got so frustrated with their stubbornness that he lashed out in physical anger. And then there was Peter, the vocal leader of the disciples, the one that was very loudly confident in his own abilities. And when push came to shove, when he was really tested, he revealed that he was actually kind of a coward. And so the Bible is unafraid of showing us that even these people, these great heroes of the faith, still had a bunch of flaws. And their flaws point to the fact that there is really only one true perfect hero, and that is Jesus. So today, as we're spending time in 2 Samuel 11 and 12, we're going to watch as David's life takes a turn. See, thus far, David had been very honorable. He had been a man of faith. He had been following God's lead. God had orchestrated David's entire path to the throne. But now that he is king, his position is changing, and it's changing him. So let's look at it, 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 5. Now, I got to give you a fair warning, all right? My style, if anybody's ever heard, like, I love having fun. I love cracking jokes. This one's going to be pretty heavy, all right? So hang in there. But I believe it's important because if we just pretend that this isn't heavy, then we're kind of pretending life isn't heavy. And frankly, some of us know this all too well today. That life can be heavy, and that's exactly what David experiences here in chapter 11, all right? So hang with me, here we go, 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 5. It says, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. See, things were different about David, and David had become different. Now that he was the king, he kind of felt like he had arrived. And that's a very dangerous feeling for most of us. See, when we feel like we've arrived, we become comfortable, and we become secure in our surroundings. And you and I know that if you've interacted with God much at all, there is a difference between the way we interact with God when things are hard versus when things are good, isn't there? Now, when things are difficult, when I'm in a season of challenge, maybe it's a season of loss or pain or frustration, my dialogue with God is at an all-time high. I'm asking questions. I'm seeking his guidance. I want his input and his wisdom. And so I'm talking to him all the time. But when I've arrived or I feel comfortable or things are going pretty well, my dialogue decreases significantly. And I feel like things are going pretty well. And there's even this moment where I kind of convince myself that I am the reason that things are going pretty well, so I don't really need God's help, so I'm not going to talk to him all that much. And now that David was on the throne, and now that he had all the fame and fortune and power that he could ever want, he slipped into spiritual cruise control. And he stopped talking to God as much, and his relationship with God had kind of stalled out because things were easy and things were comfortable. So not only was David comfortable, not only was he in cruise control, but it says it was the spring of the year, and that's where armies went to fight. Now, the reason they would fight in the spring is because the weather was better and because food was naturally growing in the field for them to eat. And so David, as the leader of the nation, sent his army to go fight a distant battle. Now, you can imagine, as the commander-in-chief, when your army is at a distant battle, it elevates your stress and your anxiety, right? And I don't know about you, but when I'm stressed out, I am not at my best. I'm not thinking clearly. I usually jump to some conclusions. And so here's David. He slipped into spiritual cruise control, and he's stressed out at work. And then, Samuel writes it, he says, it kind of happened. Did you notice that? It just happened one day that he was on a walk, and there she was. You know, it doesn't say that David went looking for temptation, but temptation definitely found him. David did not sit at his computer and Google naked woman on the roof, all right? But he did see her, and David wasn't ready for it. See, when he had slipped into cruise control a long time ago, his defenses were lowered. He wasn't ready to fight back, and on a better day, David would have looked away. And on a better day, he would have left the roof. And on a better day, he would have fled sexual temptation, but he wasn't ready. He wasn't ready to fight back. You see, the truth is that sin like David's right there. Decisions like David's do not just start at 100. They don't just start. David didn't just wake up one day and say, hey, I'm going to commit adultery with a married woman. He didn't decide that day. It had been growing inside of him for a very long time. See, the way sin works is that it usually starts very small in our heart and then grows. In fact, it starts about the size of an acorn. This is an acorn here. This is a seed. Now, full disclosure, this is not a real acorn. It's hard to find acorns in June, all right? But this is a plastic acorn, the size of an acorn nonetheless, right? This is a seed. Not very impressive. Not something that you would look at. If you're passing it on the sidewalk, you just keep walking. It's nothing to write home about. But given enough time, this seed starts sprouting roots. And given some more time, it grows some branches until eventually it becomes a massive oak tree. Out of this small seed comes an immovable object. And sin in our hearts, it usually starts as small as a seed, and given enough time, gone long enough unaddressed, it becomes an immovable object that takes over our hearts. You see, David didn't wake up one day with the oak tree of adultery in his heart. It was an acorn a long time ago when he slipped into cruise control. When he felt like he kind of had it all together, when he realized he didn't need God's help, that's when it started. It wasn't there on the rooftop. So you can almost hear King David standing on the roof, kind of rationalizing his behavior, can't you? You know, it's hard being the king. You got to make a lot of tough decisions, and everybody online thinks they can do your job better than you, and everybody's on these chat boards saying, this is what I would do if I were the king. And not only that, but he's lived a pretty good life. Like, he's obeyed God. He's really followed him all the way. He probably deserves this. I mean, one little cheat, one little step out of bounds, God will understand. God wants me to be happy. I'm the king. I want her. I know she's someone else's one, but I want that one. I'm taking her. And as you and I know, and as we've said here a few different times, desires are terrible decision makers. See, desires, what I want, is not always what is best. Desires are terrible decision makers. See, sometimes what I desire leads me down a path of destruction. And sometimes what I want, if I follow that desire, it will hurt the people I love. Yet you and I, we live in a world that kind of as a culture, we've all decided that what I desire is what I should have. If I want it, then I'm going to get it. Because I think I'm naturally a good person, at least I think that. And so what I desire must be good. And so I'm going to allow my desires to be my decision makers, and then we end up with messes like David's. And David desired her, and then he took her. See, that language is very, very clear on purpose, that this was not the acts of consenting adults. This was a man of power abusing a woman who could not say no. And David used Bathsheba for his sexual gratification, and then he sent her home. This was not the budding of a romantic relationship. This was a one-night stand. And then Bathsheba sends David a note with three words: I am pregnant. Now, in the right relationship, those three words provide immeasurable joy. But in the wrong relationship, they provide grief and anxiety. And there we have King David, and he's at a crossroads that you and I have experienced in our own lives. See, we had two choices. There were two different paths. One path was the path of recovery and redemption, owning his sin and really reconciling with God. The other path was the path called cover-up. And David made the same decision that you and I have made on multiple occasions in our lives. He was going to cover this up. See, David's master plan was that he was going to invite Bathsheba's husband home from the battlefield. So David invited Uriah there to his house for dinner, and his plan was, if I send Uriah home, because they've been apart for so long, they'll sleep together, and then in 9 months, no one will know any different. The community will assume it was Uriah's baby. Uriah will assume it was Uriah's baby. Bathsheba will be so ashamed that she'll never say anything, and these famous last words, no one has to know. But the problem was that King David underestimated Uriah. In fact, Uriah's integrity was greater than the king's. Uriah looked back at the king and he said, King David, my guys, my soldiers, they're still in battle. They're encamped all the way over there. They don't get to be with their wives. Why should I be with mine? He said, I won't go. And then David tried again the next night, and then they had dinner again, and David got Uriah drunk, assuming that because he was inebriated, he would lower his standards. But even through blurred vision, Uriah could still see the difference between right and wrong. He refused to go home again. And David knew that his cover-up had a time clock. And he knew the window was getting smaller and smaller for him to pull this off. And so he pulled out the emergency plan. And David wrote a note, and he sent it with Uriah back to the battlefield. The note was for the commander, Joab, and David told Joab that the next time they were engaged in battle, put Uriah at the front in the line of danger. And when archers start shooting their arrows, pull back and leave Uriah out to die. This was David's plan. But you can imagine, as the commander of the army, Joab couldn't control all the circumstances. So when he executed the plan, multiple soldiers died so that Uriah would die. The king, the one who was supposed to have his people's best interest in mind, the one who was supposed to protect his soldiers, killed multiple men to cover up his affair. This is a dark moment in the life of David. Once Bathsheba had finished mourning the loss of her husband, David took her in to be one of his wives, to live with him. And from the outside, this would have looked like a very honorable thing to do. You see, in this culture, someone needed to take care of the widow. She couldn't provide for herself, she didn't have a son, and so she was left on her own. And from the community's perspective, it would have looked like the king was being compassionate. Look at this guy. He's taking care of the widow of his fallen warrior, his fallen soldier. What a good guy. So David had flipped what was potentially an embarrassing scandal to looking like a champ. This was the cover-up to end all cover-ups. He had fooled the community. He had fooled the army. But there was one problem. Look at what it says in verse 27. It says, "And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house. And she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord." See, David could pull the wool over the eyes of the community. He could fool the army, but he was not fooling God. God saw it all, and God saw through the facade, and God saw into David's heart. And as Charles Spurgeon once said, God does not allow his children to sin successfully. And so God puts a plan into motion. And he calls out this prophet named Nathan. A prophet's job was to hear from God and deliver God's message to his people unfiltered. That was his job. It was a tough one. And so God would say things, and then the prophet would go and deliver that message, and it wasn't always that fun. And here we have Nathan with the unenviable job of confronting the king. Remember, no one says no to the king. No one confronts the king. And here comes Nathan. Look at what he does in the beginning of chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. It says, "And the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him, 'There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, the man who had done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity.'" So here Nathan wisely confronts David with a story. He doesn't start with the punch to the gut. He begins with a story, and it's the story of a man with all the power who abused a man who had only one thing. And apparently, David did not get the story, all right? That seems pretty clear. Now, either David was completely in denial, or he had lived so long with his secret that he had convinced himself it was okay. And maybe you've done that. Maybe you've lived with the secret for so long, for months and years, that you played it over and over in your head, and you saw it from all the different angles, and you lived it with it for so long that it's become part of who you are. It's actually become part of your identity. It's part of your past. And because you need to face the day, you've been able to rationalize it away to where you feel okay with that sin. That may have been where David was. But Nathan refused to allow David to ignore the obvious truth. Look how he confronts him here in verse 7, four powerful words. Nathan said to David, "You are the man." Man, you are the man. The prophet said to the king, "You are the man." I imagine David just fell back into his chair. Now Nathan knew. David thought he had pulled it off. David thought he had covered it up. And not only did Nathan know, but God knew. This is what we call rock bottom. And some of you have experienced it. It's that moment where the darkest thing you've ever done, the thing that you were doing everything to cover up, the thing that you had rationalized away, the thing that you had pretended never happened, it was found out. someone knew, some two knew, and then everybody, it felt like the world knew what you had done. And David was laid bare there in the throne room, confronted by his friend Nathan, and confronted, most importantly, by God. God's message to David was clear. He said, David, man, I gave you everything. I gave you the throne, and I gave you the power, and I gave you this palace, and I even promised to give you so much more. And you went and took the one thing that wasn't yours. You messed it all up, David. And now all this peace that you've been experiencing in your family, it's gone. Your family will be defined by dysfunction for the rest of your life. And on top of that, you're not getting away with this for any longer. See, David had been covering this up for over 9 months. He had been pretending and lying all over the place, and God said, no more. Look how God says it, verse 12. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. See, God promises to expose David's secret. Now, why would God do that, right? I mean, wasn't it enough that Nathan, his friend, now knew his deepest, darkest secret? And wasn't it enough that God knew? And wasn't it enough that when he saw Bathsheba and he saw the baby, he was reminded of what he'd done? Like, wasn't that enough? Doesn't this seem just mean-spirited? Doesn't this seem vindictive to drag out all of David's dirty laundry into the sun? Why would he do that? Well, here's the truth. It's that nothing healthy grows in the dark, right? Nothing healthy grows in the dark. Maybe you've been in a house or a building where it hadn't been opened up for a long time, and someone threw open the doors or the windows, and out came dust, and it was musty, and the things that were growing in there were things like mold and fungus and things you would not want. That's the kind of stuff that grows in the dark. And here's the truth, is that sin, left unattended, does not just shrink, and it does just not dissipate, and it doesn't just go away, it only grows. See, remember, sin does not start as the oak tree, it begins as the acorn. And when we plant the seeds of sin in the darkness of our hearts, they grow unless we do something about it. So when we allow the seeds of doubt to be planted in the darkness of our hearts, then we do not attend to them, they grow into insecurity and paranoia. Or when we allow the seeds of frustration to be planted into the darkness of our hearts, it grows into anger and cynicism. Or when we allow the seeds of curiosity to be planted in our hearts, it grows into lust and to addiction. See, sin unattended does not shrink and does not dissolve. It only grows. So God was not interested in just forgiving David of this one sin, this one time. The reason God was dragging out David's dirty laundry was to expose it so that he could kill it. God was not just interested in forgiving this one instance. He wanted to kill the sin that was growing inside of David. Now, here we are again with another situation where David's response says a lot about his character. No one says no to the king. No one confronts the king. David easily could have had Nathan killed right there in the moment for even speaking to him like that. But watch how David responds. My suggestion is that David's response to this confrontation should set the tone for the way we confess our sin. David's simple words were these. Verse 13, I have sinned against the Lord. David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Simple to the point. He said, I have sinned. See, David confessed without denial or excuse. First of all, David confessed without denial. He didn't lie about it. He didn't dance around it. He didn't run from it. He said, yeah, I did that. On the rooftop, I was there, I was in control, I could have stopped, but I didn't, I wanted that thing. And the confession without denial says, you know what, I made that decision because I wanted to. And that's a different kind of line that most of us don't deliver. They're like, hey, I sinned because I wanted to do that thing. Because I thought it would be fun. I thought it would feel good. I thought it was better than what God was offering me, so I chose to sin. That's what David says. Confession says, I own it, and then he did it without excuse. See, David did not shift blame. He did not blame his stress at work. He didn't say it was a result of his circumstances. He didn't look at Nathan and say, man, she was the one that was naked on the roof. Like, what was I supposed to do? I'm just a man. I can't control my urges. This isn't my fault. It's really her fault. Really, I'm a good guy because I took her to be my wife. He didn't do any of that. He confessed without denial, without excuse. He owned it. He said, it was my decision alone. And I did it because I wanted to. It wasn't anyone else's fault. And then he recognized against whom he had sinned. Not only had David hurt the people in his family, not only had he hurt Bathsheba, not only had he killed Uriah, but he also hurt the God that he loved. You see, he understood that the biggest ramification of his decision was the effect on his relationship with God. There was now this great chasm between him and God that didn't used to exist. There was this great separation that he couldn't close. He had a problem he couldn't solve. And he said, I have sinned against the Lord. I know that. I own it. You see, God was leading David to confess because he knew that this was the only way for him to heal. John Owen once said that be killing sin or it will be killing you. Right? Be killing sin or it will be killing you. You see, in the battle between us and sin, one of us will always be the aggressor. Right? There's no neutral in the battle between us and sin. Either we will be aggressively attacking our sin or it will be aggressively attacking us, but there's no neutral. There's no standing path. One of us is taking ground. And so God was leading David along this path of confession. It was very embarrassing. It was very painful. But it was because God wanted to kill the sin that was about to take over David's heart. See, growing up, my dad, he's a plumber by trade. And when you think about the most convenient people to grow up with, a plumber is one of them, right? Things got fixed in our house like all the time growing up. Now that I have my own house and my own family, we just learned to deal with broken stuff, right? Like, I don't know how to do stuff at all. But one day, my dad, he took me on a job, and it was to this elderly couple's house, and it was well manicured on the outside. We went inside, everything was put together. It kind of like smelled like your grandma's house, right? Like whatever that smell is, apricots, I think. I don't know, but you know, that's what it felt like. Everything looked good, but they said, we have a problem. They said, our garbage disposal does not work. And my dad said, okay, we're gonna fix that. And he told me our job was to get in the crawl space underneath this house. It was on a summer day, we're on our hands and knees, crawling underneath this house. Now, he did not tell me what the solution was to a broken garbage disposal. He just told me to get under the house. He said, grab this bag, take this tool. I'm like, okay, Dad, here we go. You know, like, I don't know what's gonna happen. I give him the saw, all right, that was the tool. And he puts it against the pipe and he just starts cutting. Cutting. Apparently the solution to a clogged garbage disposal is to cut the pipe and let it all flow out, all right? I did not know that. It was the worst thing that I've ever smelled in my entire life. I do not know how long it had been clogged. I'm guessing around 45 years, all right? That was my experience, all right? There were decades of grossness all up in this pipe. Now, when I think of confession, unfortunately, I think about that pipe. You see, what happens in my life, mine, maybe not yours, but definitely mine, is that when I sin without the regular act of confession, I'm just jamming sin into the pipe over and over and over again. And it's piling up and it's backing up until stuff stops working and life stops flowing. And I have to keep up with what I told people and I have to keep up with the act that I'm keeping up so that no one really finds out what's in the pipe. But confession is cutting the pipe. Confession is the solution to unclogging all the stuff that's holding up our lives. The reason that some of us are stalled out in life is because we've clogged this thing up and we haven't provided the solution. Now, I would love to tell you about a different kind of confession that is very pretty. And I would love to tell you that there's such a confession that smells good. There's not. Confession is going to be embarrassing. There's going to be some pain. There's going to be some shame. But it is the solution, like the singular solution to living the life of freedom, that we cannot unclog that life. We cannot unclog the sin any other way. And so God was dragging David's secret out into the sun, not to embarrass him, not to hurt his feelings, but simply so that he could live the life of freedom that God intended. That's why David needed to confess. And so David saw his sin completely exposed, unfiltered, there for everyone to see. He confessed without denial or excuse. And then watch what God does next. Verse 13. And Nathan said to David these amazing words. The Lord also put away your sin. You shall not die. You see, before David could offer an animal sacrifice, before David could say a special prayer with some special words, God forgave David of his sin. See, the language is very, very clear. It said that God put away David's sin. See, you and I, our sin can't just be forgiven. Someone has to pay the debt that we owed. David owed a debt for his adultery. David owed a debt for the cover-up, and he could not pay it. So this is the moment, like we've been doing all summer long, where we say, hey, everybody, by the way, this isn't about David anymore. David is not the main character of his story any more than you and I are the main character of our story. This is now about Jesus. Right? This is about Jesus. You see, God had to put David's sin away and put it on someone else. And that is the good news of the gospel, is that Jesus was the one that took the sin of David's. Jesus is the one that took the sin of you and me. Our sin has been put away on someone else. Someone else paid the debt that we owed. And so David was able to experience forgiveness and freedom, not because of anything that David did. It wasn't about the sacrifice. It wasn't about the prayer. It wasn't about David living a really good life for the next decade, finally paying off the debt. He couldn't pay it. Jesus was the one that paid the debt for David's sin, and he paid the debt for you and me. This is why it's so important. This is why confession is so important, right? Confession is not payback, it's surgery, right? Confession is not payback. God wasn't being vindictive. He didn't have hurt feelings. He wasn't trying to get back at David. What he was trying to do was do heart surgery on David. Because like we said, God was interested in more than just forgiving David of this one sin. He wanted to kill the sin that was growing inside. You see, surgery on us, our heart surgery, is God getting inside and rewiring some stuff. Rewiring some stuff so that we can look more like him. See, there are two different kinds of prayers that we pray when we confess our sin, when we repent. One sounds like this. Right? Hey, God, it's me again. I did that thing that I said I wasn't going to do again. I really appreciate all the forgiveness. I'll try harder next time. Right? That is not the prayer of repentance. In fact, trying harder next time has never worked for a single person ever. In fact, the prayer of repentance looks like this. Hey, God, it's me, and I did that thing, and I own it. That was me. I chose that. And God, I want you to change me. And I don't want to want that anymore. I want you to change my desires. So I desire the things of you instead of the things of me. I want you to get inside, and I know it's going to hurt, and I know it's going to be invasive, and I know it might be a little embarrassing for you to see all the stuff I've been keeping down there, but you know already. So rewire me to love the things of you. See, David confessed not so that God could get even, but so that God could change him. And that's the beauty of confession. Now, even though God was forgiving of David, it doesn't mean that there weren't very real consequences to David's decision. Right? There were very real, earthly, temporary consequences to the decision that David made. In fact, David and Bathsheba, they lost their son. They lost that baby because of David's sin. And while sin can be spiritually forgiven, it can still have immediate, painful consequences here on earth. Affairs can be forgiven, but they can wreak havoc on family relationships. And addictions can be forgiven, but they can have negative impacts on our physical and emotional and relational health. See, David was forgiven. His spiritual status was as if he had not sinned. But it doesn't mean that it didn't affect his life here on earth. But the story doesn't end there. See, this is a story of redemption. David and Bathsheba went on to have another baby, and his name was Solomon. And Solomon was the heir to the throne. Solomon would grow to be the wisest man that ever lived. Solomon was the fulfillment of God's promise to David. Notice this, all right? Chronologically speaking, God made a promise. David messed up. God kept using David. That's a very important timeline there. God made a promise. David messed up, but God wasn't done with him yet. He put away his sin on someone else and kept using David. Kept using David. Now, that's so important because some of us have convinced ourselves that God made a promise to me, but I messed it up so bad that there's no way he could keep using me. That's not the story of David. The story of grace says, yes, God made a promise. Yes, you messed up, but Jesus paid the price for that, so you have a future. This is a beautiful story of redemption. So what does the story of David and Bathsheba, what about David's mistake? What about David's decision? What about his sin impacts the way you and I live? I asked three questions of myself this week as I was reading this. I'd like for you to ask the same questions and answer them honestly for yourself. Question number one is this. All right, what sin are you tolerating? What sin are you tolerating? Again, no one starts at rock bottom. That's not the way it works. No one starts at their worst moment. They ease in. It starts small as an acorn and grows to the big as an oak tree. What sin currently are you tolerating? It's not yet taken over, but it could. And right now you describe it as kind of your challenge, your struggle, and you know it's something you're wrestling with. But left unattended, it's not going to shrink. It's only going to grow. C.S. Lewis, he wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters, and it's an illustration of the way temptation works in our lives. And here's how he described it. He said, "Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one. The gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts." See, temptation is not going to start us at rock bottom. It's going to ease us in, and we won't even feel it. And then one day we'll be on the rooftop, and our guard will be down, and we'll make a decision, and we will make a choice, and we will end up where we never thought we would be. So let me ask you, students, in your dating relationships right now, I know it started as just some innocent kissing when parents and friends weren't around, but it's going to feel good, and you're going to want more. And if left unattended, those seeds that are growing in the darkness of our hearts will put you in positions to compromise your purity and make decisions you will regret for the rest of your life. Are you tolerating it? Because left unattended, that sin will kill you. Or maybe it was at work, and you told everybody that it was just a season, and as soon as this project was over, you'd be back home, and you'd be re-engaged, and you'd have time for the kids. But along the way, you became addicted to the busyness, and you wore your fatigue as a badge of honor, and it gave you your identity because you were needed at work, and maybe you didn't feel all that needed at home, and so now you are a workaholic. It didn't start that way. It started small, and it grew, and then it took over. Or maybe it was just one simple story this one time, and you didn't really mean it. You just kind of let it slip, but you aired out someone else's dirty laundry, and it felt good. It felt good to acknowledge that you weren't the only one that was struggling with stuff, and it felt good to show how they weren't all that perfect after all, and now what started as a very small seed has become the fact that you can't have a single conversation without talking about someone behind their back. Gossip has taken over. It starts small, and it grows, and it grows, and it grows. So what sin right now are you tolerating? The one that seems small, the one that seems like it's not going to be all that big of a deal. May I suggest that either we are killing sin or it is killing us. One of us will be the aggressor. So let's kill the sin today through the power of Jesus. Second question is this. All right, second question, ask yourself honestly. Who gets to call you out? Right? Who gets to call you out? You see, in this story with David and Nathan, David needed Nathan because Nathan was more than a prophet. He was more than just a mouthpiece for God. He was David's friend. And the relationship between David and Nathan could sustain the confrontation. And that was wildly important. That Nathan knew that this relationship could hold up underneath the pressure of the confrontation. God sent Nathan on purpose because he knew that David, left to his own devices, was going to allow this to grow until it took over. He needed to be called out. See, here at Traders Point, man, we believe that life happens best in community. We love gathering as this big group, but we believe that this is only part of the expression. We believe this is only part of the process. And we want this big group to be broken down into small groups. And so that's why we do life groups. Man, we believe that not only does life happen best in community, but so does spiritual growth. And again, left to my own device, I will not offer this stuff up. I will not offer this darkness unless I have multiple Nathans in my life that have permission to call me out. So who have you given the keys to confront you? See, I'm in a group with three other guys. We have a men's life group. We meet on Tuesday mornings every week at Cracker Barrel. Sam is our waitress. Sometimes she pays for our coffee. It's awesome, all right? Like, that's great. And we talk about the Bible, and we talk about our families, and then I have invited those three guys to be my Nathans, all right? Maybe I'm worse than David. I need three Nathans, all right? That's like what it's like with me. And so I said, guys, look, here's my struggles. Here's where I know I'm weak. Here's where I know that I slip, and you guys have 100% permission to call me out when you see it, right? You have that. I trust you. I love you enough. Our relationship can sustain the confrontation. You get to call me out. So this Tuesday, I was saying, look, guys, I feel like right now my speech has gone out of control, that the way I talk to people is not lifting them up, it's not encouraging them, it's not loving them. In fact, I'm really good at having jokes on hand, like I can cut people down, I'm really sarcastic, it's my spiritual gift, all right? Like, I have all that. And this weird thing happens, like, no one appreciates my gift, all right? Like, no one comes to me and like, oh, man, that was so cool how you made fun of me in front of all those people. Like, I feel so much better now. And I said, look, guys, like, I feel like it has gone from this, like, kind of endearing, funny thing to where I'm losing influence. And I feel like I'm actually hurting some people in the process, and I'm not honoring Christ with my words. And so you guys, you're around me all the time. You have 100% permission to call me out on the spot. You don't have to wait till later. You don't have to send me an email. You get to call me out because I am willing to face that scrutiny. I'm willing to face that embarrassment because I know that if I'm not aggressively killing the sin in my heart, it will kill me. So who gets to call you out? Who have you intentionally invited, given the keys, 100% permission, you're not going to get mad at them, you're not going to quit talking to them, who gets to call you out? Right, final question is this, answer this honestly. What do you need to bring to the light? Right, what do you need to bring to the light in a room like this? I know we look good, and I know we sound good, and we kind of look all put together, but there's some dark burdens here in this room. And there are some secrets that have been growing for days and weeks and months and maybe years. Stuff that you've never talked about, stuff that you've been covering up, stuff that you hoped no one would ever have to know. And I just like to suggest that that's not healthy, that that disease will eventually take over, and that confession is the road to freedom and to healing. Is it possible that today's the day that you can steal the power back from the sin because it's no longer a secret? Sin loses its power as soon as we start talking about it, as soon as we start praying about it, as soon as we start sharing it. So can we just together start embracing the fact that we need to talk about some stuff that we've been avoiding talking about for a long time? See, at the end of the service, there's going to be some people down here, and they would love to meet you and greet you, and they'd love to pray with you. And here's why I have ultimate confidence that they will receive you well. It's because they are sinners in need of a Savior just like you. That they have experienced the same grace that David experienced and the grace that you need. And so there is no intimidation. There is no frustration. You can easily come here and be prayed for. I'd like to suggest that this may be the very first day that instead of taking the path of cover-up, we take the path to recovery. To where God is going to do some work on our hearts, do some surgery. And then finally, we can live the life of freedom he intended. I'd love to pray for you. I'd love to pray for the courage to take that step to where through confession, God can give us the life of freedom that he intended. Will you pray? Father, we come to you and we are humbled and we are broken. And man, there's just a lot of stuff built up. And we don't want to talk about it and it's going to be embarrassing, but like it's eating us alive. So will you give us the courage to say something? For the first time, for the 10th time, for the 1,000th time, will you give us the courage to step forward and own it? Without denying it, without excuse, that you give us the courage to lay it all out. God, we need your grace. And we are so grateful that you sent your son, you put our sin on him, that he paid the price that we couldn't pay. So give us the courage to take hold of your promise that you will forgive, you will redeem, and you will give us freedom. It's in your incredible name I pray. Amen.